Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Muscawain. Climate, medicine, and taxes. Those are the big ticket items included in the long anticipated Inflation Reduction Act that Congress has been working on for some time. It's a multi-billion dollar piece of legislation that provides for significant investment in clean energy, among other climate change priorities. It would also keep health insurance premiums down for millions of low and middle income Americans and would lower some prescription drug prices. There is also a provision for a 15% minimum tax on the earnings that large corporations, those making over $1 billion, report to investors. We'll take a closer look at what's in the bill a bit later, but we begin with the economy. While gas prices have finally dipped just below $4 a gallon, putting food on the table, as you know, still costs significantly more than it used to, which might make it hard to believe that inflation is actually slowing down, but new data released this week suggests that indeed it is. Here to explain why that is and help us get a handle on what's going on with the economy is Dr. Alan Blinder. He is professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. He served as a member of President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisors and then as vice chairman of the Federal Reserve. Dr. Blinder, welcome to Radio Times.
Nice to be with you.
So the Consumer Price Index came out yesterday and seems to tell us that inflation is slowing down. And yet anybody, as we mentioned, who's gone food shopping in the last few months might find that hard to believe. How do you account for the disconnect there?
Well, I think you use the right word, slowing down. So prices were soaring at the highest inflation rates in 40 odd years. And after the last reading, they're soaring a bit more slowly than that. But you're still talking at the CPI level, headline inflation, 8.5%, which is extraordinarily high. Better than 9.1, for sure, but way too high.
And 9.1 was the number from June, correct?
Right, that's right.
So we've gotten some relief at the gas pump, as we mentioned. It's now dipped just below $4 a gallon. But do you expect that gas prices will continue to drop, or could we see another increase? How do you see that going?
I do, in the near term, expect them to drop. Now, as you look, and the reason for that is that crude oil has dropped, and there's a lag between what happens to crude oil and what happens to gasoline at the pump. Indeed, some of us were praying, our prayers were not answered, that piece of the CPI would slow down last month. It didn't. The lower crude hadn't filtered into the retail level yet. This last reading it did, and for the next couple, it probably will. What happens beyond that is a big question mark. The best guess, I think, is it still falls or levels off or falls, but there are all kinds of uncertainties having to do with what's going on in Ukraine. As we know, that was the cause of the most recent run-up in crude oil prices, the withdrawal of fuel that used to come out of Ukraine and Russia and is down to a trickle now. It's anybody's guess what's going to happen to that over the next 3, 4, or 5 months.
So many of us understood that the hike in food prices was, to some degree at least, related to the hike in gas prices in terms of transporting food. Just as a follow-up, if gas prices are coming down, why is food still so expensive, or do you expect that that will follow?
Well, what you said was right, but I think a minor cause of the food inflation. Yes, food goes in trucks, and trucks burn fuel, and it costs more when gasoline is more expensive. That's true, absolutely true. But I was just talking about the war in Ukraine. Another huge effect of the war in Ukraine is the impeding of shipments of grain, corn, and a variety of other agricultural outputs. Ukraine was known as the breadbasket of Europe. Now, knock on wood, there are some hopeful signs. As we all know, some ships have left Ukrainian ports loaded with grain recently for the first time in a while. But that interruption of grain and other supplies in the war-torn areas was a much bigger factor in food inflation than the secondary effect via transportation costs, which, as I said, is there, but numerically it's not nearly as large.
As you well know, all of the inflation information has led to fears of recession. Does that remain a threat, even as we're seeing inflation beginning to slow down? Are we right to still be concerned about the possibility of recession?
Yeah, I think we are right. We're sort of on the cusp. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. It's a little bit like a nickel standing on its edge. If you look at the economy now, indicators of what's going on in labor markets, jobs, are very, very good. There are lots of jobs. People are getting hired to jobs at really quite amazing rates, given how tight the labor market already is. If you look, on the other hand, at GDP reports, the last GDP reports has been widely reported have been negative, actually, flukishly negative, one because of import soaring, one because of inventories. But even if you get, even if you ignore that or sort of factor it out of your numbers, as a lot of us economists do, the GDP growth has been weak in the last two quarters. And on top of that, you have what I was talking about before, the oil shocks and the food shocks, which in the past have often led to stagflation and have contributed to stagflationary forces right now. And finally, I didn't mention many people, if this was a financial program, your question would have led with that. The Federal Reserve is raising interest rates, and that's explicitly designed to take some steam out of the economy. And if it takes too much steam out, the economy will turn around and go negative.
Well, since you mentioned the Fed, let's talk about that a little bit, because they have been aggressively raising interest rates of late. What do you anticipate they'll do when they meet in September? Do you think that this more encouraging news will cause them to take a gentler stance, or how do you see it going next time?
Well, it depends what you mean by gentler. A lot of market people are getting steamed up about another 0.75 percentage point at the next meeting, which is in September. I never believed that. I mean, it was possible, depending on how the news came in. But I always thought it would be more like a 0.5 percentage point, 50 basis points. And that's where the markets are now. I think that's realistic. You want to think of the Fed as in a hurry because of inflation to get interest rates back up to normal levels. Remember, interest rates were near zero for a very long time. And that's an uncomfortable place for the central bank to be, unless the economy is dead in the water, which was the case at the beginning of the pandemic, but not any longer. So the central bank feels it's incumbent upon it to normalize interest rates. And so 50 more basis points in September will be part of that.
You mentioned the good jobs news that we have been seeing. And I think for a lot of us who are not economists, there can be a bit of a disconnect because we saw these really good job numbers, but then we're also hearing about a lot of layoffs, particularly in the tech industry. So how do you square that?
Well, I think you square it very easily. In a dynamic economy, whether it's the labor market is going sour or whether the labor market is booming, there's always two-way movement. There are always people losing their jobs or quitting their jobs, and there are always people gaining jobs. The jobs report that we get once a month is the net of those two. It's how many new jobs were created minus how many old jobs were destroyed. And so you're always going to get stories in both directions. There's no doubt that we have very, despite the reports of layoffs here and there, there's no doubt that we have a very, very strong labor market right now. Businesses are scrambling for workers still to this day. Most, again, I want to say not every business, but more businesses than not are scrambling for workers.
I want to talk about the Inflation Reduction Act, which is expected to pass the House soon and land on the president's desk. And part of that bill includes a minimum 15% tax increase on corporations that report more than $1 billion in profits. There are Republicans who are saying that this is going to hurt the economy and kill jobs. Do you think that that's a fair assessment, or what do you think the outcome will be?
No. Republicans for decades and decades have been screaming that every tax increase is going to kill the economy. I don't know when they'll stop doing that. They've been wrong, wrong, wrong. Now, I don't want to say that tax increases are the way to give the economy a boost. Taxes are the way we pay the government's bills. And if we had bills, we need to have taxes. I think everybody understands that. Well, everybody except Republican politicians understands that. There isn't any reason to think this particular tax is going to have a tremendously deleterious effect on the economy. A little negative? Yeah, maybe. I can believe that, but completely overwhelmed by other things in the bill that give the economy a boost, like more spending on green energy and things like that, and lowered prescription drug prices and other things like that. Those will swamp the effects of this 15% minimum tax. And let's remember the number, 15%. We are not talking about a titanically high tax rate and only levied on profitable companies. That is to say, companies that tell their shareholders they're highly profitable, but because of loopholes, tell the IRS they don't have any profits to tax. This is not going to kill business.
Yeah. Well, as we mentioned, the name of this legislation is the Inflation Reduction Act. And as you just pointed out, it's got a lot of money earmarked for fighting climate change, for addressing prescription drug costs and health insurance premiums. The question is the bill likely to live up to its name? That is, do you anticipate that it really will reduce inflation?
Well, yes, if you're not too fussy about magnitudes. I heard somebody on the air, I think last night, I don't remember who it was, say that whoever named it the Inflation Reduction Act should get an award for advertising. Yes, it's anti-inflationary. It is on net. I don't doubt that. I don't think hardly any economists doubt that. But you don't want to exaggerate the magnitudes, and that's not its main purpose. Its main purposes were fairness in the tax code, as we were just talking about, pushing the economy in the direction of greener energy, controlling drug prices, and reducing the deficit, by the way, which we haven't mentioned yet. That's what this act is about. If you add all that up, it probably comes down to a negative on inflation. But I worry a little that people will expect inflation to tumble a lot and rapidly because of this legislation. They shouldn't. They should expect it to come down a bit slowly because of this inflation. That's a good thing.
Well, we will have plenty to be watching out for in the coming weeks and months. We have to take a break here. Dr. Alan Blinder, thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Dr. Blinder is professor of economics and public affairs at Princeton University. When Radio Times comes right back, we'll talk about that Inflation Reduction Act and what's in it for you, that and more, after this.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowane. The U.S. is on the verge of making an unprecedented investment in the fight against climate change, assuming that the Inflation Reduction Act that made it through the Senate passes the House as expected. The legislation not only provides hundreds of billions of dollars for investment in clean energy, it also includes provisions that would keep health insurance premiums and prescription drug prices relatively low for millions of Americans. And then there is the corporate tax hike, a revenue raiser that will require large corporations to pay a minimum 15% tax on profits they report to shareholders. Now, the bill is a far cry from what Democrats originally wanted, but the final whittled-down version was enough to win the necessary Senate votes to set it on a path to becoming law. Joining us now with more on the bill and why it's being viewed as historic are our guests, Andrew Doran, who covers the Treasury Department and economic policy for the Wall Street Journal's Washington Bureau. He previously covered Congress for the Journal. Andy, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Marianne Levine. She is a reporter for Politico who covers the Senate. Marianne, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you.
So, Andy, I'll begin with you. The three major items in this bill, climate, medicine, and taxes, would seem to be totally unrelated to one another. So how did they all end up in the same legislation, and what's the connection there?
Yeah, so the reason that these three buckets have survived the long process that Democrats went through over the last year and a half, more or less, is for a couple of reasons. One, Democrats wanted to pay for whatever spending that they ultimately passed into law. And so to pay for spending, you need to raise taxes. And so raising taxes was always an element of Democrats' goal for this legislation. They always wanted to be able to at least pay for the new spending that they were hoping to approve. And so in this legislation, they actually ended up raising more taxes than they are, raising more in taxes than they are going to spend. And so there will be money that goes towards reducing the deficit. So that's why you have some of these tax plans in there. In terms of climate and healthcare, the reason that those two items, I think, are on their way to law is for a couple of reasons. One, I think climate change has become a policy issue or policy priority above others for a lot of Democrats. I think, you know, there's this sense that as the climate is warming and as the, you know, global weather is changing, that the United States has yet to pass a major climate bill, and that this is really Democrats' last chance of doing so before maybe the situation, the climate, spins out of control. And so there was really a particular sense of urgency on climate legislation that, you know, with the midterms coming up, Republicans could maybe take control of either the House or the Senate, and that this is really Democrats' last shot to pass climate legislation before emissions become too much and warming becomes too great, that, you know, the planet's climate is irrevocably changed. And so I think that's part of why that provision made it through. On healthcare, I think that's an area where Democrats have long prioritized. It's long been a central issue for the party. In elections, they are often seen as the party that is better positioned to work on healthcare issues. Lowering the cost of prescription drugs is something that both Republicans and Democrats have worked on for years and tried to make progress on, and have largely failed to. And so this is an area that's just been a big issue for voters, a big issue for Democrats for a long time. And so I think they sought to it was something, both those areas, both climate and healthcare, for those reasons, were areas where there was more unanimous support among Democrats that they ultimately needed to pass the bill in the Senate.
Yeah. Let me just take a moment to invite our listeners to join us in this conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and the number to call us is 888-477-9499. We are talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, which is expected to become law quite soon, and we're talking about what's in it for all of us. Marianne Levine, let me go to you to say that we know what the broad items are that are in the bill, as Andy just explained, but what did not make it in from the Build Back Better version?
Yeah, I mean, as Andy pointed out, this bill is substantially smaller than what Democrats had originally envisioned last year when they were trying to pass a much bigger package. A lot of the policy proposals that were in that package included legislation and ideas to address the care economy. For example, there was a proposal from Senator Bob Casey that would have assisted home health aides and provided assistance to individuals with disabilities. That provision is out. Democrats at one point wanted to extend the child tax credit. That was removed from this. And so a lot of the legislation, particularly related to social spending, was taken out in large part because of objections from Senator Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia, who largely shaped a lot of this legislation.
Well, I'm glad that you mentioned Joe Manchin, because I want to get to him in just a moment. I want to start off with climate and unpack a little bit of what is in this legislation and then talk about Joe Manchin. Andy, the bill provides nearly $370 billion here. Where is most of that money going to go as it relates to climate change initiatives?
Yeah, so a lot of this climate spending takes the form of tax credits and tax incentives for the production of clean energy. So that's wind and solar development primarily are some of the biggest beneficiaries of this legislation. But there are a lot of other types of incentives that are in there too. There's tax credits for, you know, revamped tax credits for making improvements to your home that could, you know, make it more energy efficient, things like putting in an induction stove or changing your water heater. There's now tax incentives or new tax incentives for making taking steps like that. There are tax incentives for purchasing electric vehicles that are a piece of this legislation. They're extending a $7,500 tax credit for purchasing electric vehicles. But I think the biggest piece in terms of reducing emissions will be these incentives for wind and solar development that I think are really the key, are seen as the key component for bringing down carbon emissions across the U.S. economy.
And Marianne, there's a bit of a contradiction sort of embedded in all of this, getting back to your point about Senator Joe Manchin, who was quite the holdout here. In order to gain his support, the bill also had to include a provision for leasing millions of acres of land for oil and gas drilling, which would be the opposite of fighting climate change. So how does that square, and would it in any way negate the efforts to invest in clean energy?
I think the Democrats definitely saw the inclusion of new oil drilling leases, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico and Alaska's Cook Inlet, as really the price for them to get the other climate provisions that Andy laid out. And I think what they'll argue is that this package hits their goal of reducing methane emissions, but reduces their goal of cutting greenhouse gas emissions from the 2005 levels by the end of 2030. So the concessions that they made for Senator Manchin to eventually sign on to this proposal is what they viewed that as the price to get what their ultimate goal was in here, which was the 40% cut in greenhouse gas emissions, which they're estimating will be by the end of this decade.
So let me just follow up on what you were saying about the 40% below 2005 levels by 2030. I was reading that without the bill, we'd be like 30% below. So there is certainly a significant gain there. And how much closer does that get us to fulfilling our commitment as it relates to the Paris Agreement?
It doesn't get us all the way there, but I think Democrats view this as a first step to getting to the as a first step to getting closer to the goal. But it does not get the country all the way to the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. Yeah.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowen, and we're talking about the Inflation Reduction Act and what's in it for all of us. We are expecting that it will become law sooner rather than later. Andy, to you, does this investment put us back in the game as a major player? Our status was in jeopardy for a while there as it relates to our commitment to climate change. Does this put us back in the game?
I think certainly the Biden administration and Democrats hope that this will give the United States new credibility on climate change on the global stage. Obviously, a warming planet is a global issue, and as the largest economy in the world, the United States is certainly a central player in that. And up until this point, the U.S. has not taken major policy steps, legislative steps, towards reducing carbon emissions. So I think that they do hope that when President Biden, when members of his cabinet meet with foreign leaders and talk about the importance of reducing carbon emissions, that they are now can back it up with steps they've taken at home. I mean, last year before the climate summit in Scotland, President Biden had pushed and Democrats had hoped to try and pass this legislation almost a year ago so that when he arrived for that summit that he would be able to talk about it and maybe build some momentum on the global level. And so I think that's definitely something that they're hoping to see. I mean, I think there is a question, of course, you know, when I think much of the world is familiar with the zigzag that can occur in the United States with climate policy in particular. When and if power changes back to Republican hands in Washington, there may be a different approach to some of these issues. And so I think that that's something that on the international level is always a factor. On the point about reducing carbon emissions, just one thing I wanted to mention. I think that in terms of the estimates of that, there's obviously uncertainty. And I think another important provision of the bill that could, you know, determine just how much the U.S. does ultimately reduce carbon emissions is there are these investments or proposed investments in different new forms of technology. And so there's a lot of money that goes towards trying to develop new companies and new technology to reduce carbon emissions. And so if there were to be, you know, a major breakthrough in some of that government-funded technology, then maybe that could accelerate how much carbon emissions goes down, or maybe some of that doesn't pan out the way people hope. So there is, I would just say, too, the extent to which this does reduce carbon emissions is certainly not known entirely.
Yeah. And Marianne, Andy mentioned just a few minutes ago incentives for electric vehicles that are part of this legislation. And I know that there is some confusion around that for people who are interested in purchasing electric vehicles. How would that work? What is the provision there, and how can people take advantage of that?
So if you're looking to purchase an electric vehicle and it's a new electric vehicle, there's what this legislation includes is a $7,500 tax credit for electric vehicle purchases. So that's for a new purchase. And because of the negotiations with Senator Manchin, there's some provisions in there about batteries and certain components of the electric vehicle having to be made in the United States. But basically, it's a $7,500 tax credit for newer vehicles. And I believe if you're purchasing a used vehicle, it's $3,500. It's a $3,500 tax credit. And this tax credit, to be clear, already existed before, but Democrats made some changes in this legislation. But that's the latest update.
Yeah. We have a tweet from one of our listeners who says, is there a chance that the Inflation Reduction Act won't pass the House vote tomorrow? If so, what are the risks? And can voters make a difference? Marianne Levine, I'll direct that one to you.
It's almost certain that this legislation will pass the House tomorrow. There's this is something the Democrats have been waiting for about 18 months or so. And while it's not the bill that many in the party wanted, there's sort of this reality check that everyone has come to grips with, and that is the fact that this is the best that they're going to get before the midterm election. So almost guaranteed, unless something crazy happens, that this legislation does in fact pass the House tomorrow and goes to President Biden's desk.
All right, moving on to prescription drugs. Andy Duren, the medical benefits of the bill would help to keep health insurance premiums down for a number of Americans. There's provisions relating to prescription drugs as well. How does that work?
Yeah, so there are two main health care provisions in the bill. On health insurance, so last year in 2021, when Democrats passed the American Rescue Plan, which was this big, almost $2 trillion coronavirus response package, it was the first major piece of legislation Democrats passed during the Biden administration. They included a series of subsidies for people who purchase health insurance through Affordable Care Act exchanges. And so they essentially made health insurance premiums a lot cheaper for a lot of people. There used to be these restrictions on those premiums or who could qualify for subsidies for those premiums, and they eased a lot of that and made it much more widely available. And so that made health insurance much cheaper for millions of Americans. But that provision was only, when they first passed it, was only set to last 2 years. And so Democrats were facing this cliff at the end of this year where those subsidies, the premium subsidies, were set to expire, which could have the impact of raising the cost of health insurance for millions of Americans. And so that was a big motivator for Democrats to basically extend those subsidies for another 3 years. There will still be another point in 3 years from now when Democrats and lawmakers in general will have this question of trying to extend these subsidies, but for now that question will more or less be resolved. On prescription drug prices, there are several measures that would primarily benefit Medicare recipients in the United States to in some ways cap the amount of money that they spend out of pocket on drug costs, and then also over time by 2026 empower Medicare to actually negotiate a lower price for certain prescription drugs. And so the goal is to over time just reduce the amount of money that Medicare recipients, older Americans, are spending on prescription drugs, which can be a major weight on folks' budgets.
And Marianne, Andy just talked about the negotiation, right, that Medicare can negotiate now with pharma companies about drug prices. But I guess the question is it truly a negotiation? I was reading that if the pharma companies don't agree to Medicare pricing, then they would be subject to a huge excise tax on all sales of those drugs. So is it a negotiation, or is it sort of, you know, making them an offer they can't refuse?
I think it depends on who you ask. But I think one thing that's important to note here is that, A, this is only applying, at least starting in 2026, to 10 high-cost drugs. And it eventually will go to 20 high-cost drugs, I believe, 3 years from then. But this is sort of a narrow... And it's more narrow than Democrats had originally envisioned. And so I think depending on, is it a negotiation or are drug companies forced into having no choice into doing this, is I think that really that question does depend on who you ask. But I think it's important to note that this is limited really to certain prescription drugs and is limited to at least to only 10 drugs starting in 2026. So I think how this plays out, we're not going to know its immediate effects, but it's going to also take some time for this policy to actually get implemented.
And Andy, are there any benefits in this for those who have private insurance, those who maybe purchase their own independent of an employer? Are there any benefits for people who are not on Medicare or Medicaid here?
So in terms of prescription drug costs, there Democrats had hoped to extend some of these provisions about negotiation and also capping the cost of certain drugs. One piece of the bill is that Medicare recipients can pay will only have to pay a maximum of $35 a month out of pocket for insulin, for example. And so Democrats had hoped to extend some of those provisions to the commercial market, to not just Medicare recipients. But because of some of the quirks of Senate procedure and the process that Democrats were using to pass this legislation along party lines and avoiding a filibuster in the Senate without Republican support, they were ultimately limited in how many of these provisions will be available to the commercial market. So the primary beneficiaries will definitely be Medicare recipients, but I think Democrats are still heartened by that, because obviously in many cases the people in the United States who need drugs the most and who spend the most on drugs are older Americans and folks who are on Medicare to begin with.
We are talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, which is expected to become law very soon here on Radio Times. We're taking your questions and comments about that as we talk with our guests. Much more to come on what is in this bill for you and for all of us when Radio Times comes right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about the Inflation Reduction Act. That is the new legislation. It's expected to become law quite soon. It passed the Senate over the weekend. It is going to the House, expected to pass there in the next day or so, and then land on the president's desk for signature. We've been sort of taking it apart and trying to get a sense of what is in it. And our guests are Marianne Levine, who is congressional reporter for Politico. We're also talking with Andrew Doran, who covers economic policy for the Wall Street Journal. Marianne, I want to go to you with an email from one of our listeners. Michael asks, if Republicans take back Congress in the midterms, how quickly and easily can they reverse or undermine this legislation?
It's a good question. I mean, because President Joe Biden is in office for two more years, I think the expectation is that this legislation is here to stay at least for that period. Now, if Republicans have a clean sweep in 2024 and take back the White House, the Senate, and the House, it's possible that they try to reverse these changes. But for now, at least for the next 2 years, this legislation will remain intact.
Andy, I want to shift gears now and talk about the tax provisions here. And before we get to the corporate taxes, are there any new taxes for individual households that are included in this bill?
So there are no explicit new taxes for American households. I think there are some tax plans that could, experts would say to varying degrees could trickle down or impact Americans who are not necessarily working for one of the corporations that are paying a higher tax. So one of those provisions is There's a new excise tax, 1% excise tax on stock buybacks, which some would argue could impact Americans who have 401ks or invest in the stock market to begin with. There will now be this new tax that will raise costs for corporations that want to go forward with stock buybacks. And then there's also a major new investment in the Internal Revenue Service is a key piece of the tax provisions of this plan. There's $80 billion that will be put towards revitalizing the IRS. And that money is, much of that money is going to go towards enhancing enforcement efforts for people who are maybe not paying, on people who are maybe not paying, and companies that are maybe not paying all the taxes that they owe the government. And so for people who are maybe not reporting all of their income or paying all the taxes that they should be, there is a possibility now that a revamped IRS over time could would be more likely to maybe discover that and audit that and recover that tax money.
So it sounds like, Andy, it gives the IRS a bit more bandwidth to conduct audits that they might not have been able to get around to otherwise, and then bringing in more money that way.
Yeah, that's certainly the goal. And you know, it's actually worth keeping in mind that the IRS has, in the last decade or so, been starved of a lot of resources, and they've lost a lot of staff, and their budget has been held flat or gone down over time. And so Democrats are really hoping that this money will basically rebuild the agency and allow them to go after complicated, high-income individuals who maybe have their income hidden in a lot of complicated legal arrangements, or also companies that have similar complicated tax structures and tax fees where it takes a lot of expertise and a lot of people to try and work on that and recover that money and discover what companies and high-income individuals owe in taxes. And so Democrats say that will be what that money is used for primarily, is going after large corporations and very high-income people. I think Republicans and some others have raised concerns that with this, you know, new level of IRS enforcement, that could fall on small businesses or lower-income Americans, and that just having this enhanced tax enforcement could cut a number of different ways. But Democrats in the Biden administration have committed to focusing the resources on people that have large tax bills and are maybe not paying all of it.
And Marianne Levine, just back to the corporate tax for just a moment, is there a potential trickle-down effect to workers in those corporations where maybe they wind up paying to some degree for that tax increase in lower wages or bonuses as a way that those corporations make up for what they're paying in additional taxes?
I think that's a concern that Republicans have brought up about the potential of having this additional corporate 15% minimum tax. But I think we don't quite know yet. But that is a concern, that while the tax itself is not going to have a direct impact, how corporations adjust to the tax could, as you mentioned, affect workers and benefits. But I think we don't quite know yet what the impact is going to be on workers and how companies adjust to the corporate minimum tax remains to be seen.
And Marianne, Arizona Senator Kyrsten Sinema would not sign on to this bill until she had a guarantee that firms owned by private equity industry would be protected from a tax increase. And she also wanted the so-called carried interest loophole to be preserved. Can you explain first why that was so important and why it mattered?
Yeah, so Senator Sinema, she actually has not really publicly detailed why she feels so strongly specifically about the carried interest loophole, which is really a provision that mainly really benefits private equity and hedge funds. This is something that's not a tax that affects most people. It affects a very specific division of the financial services industry. And she basically has framed her concern around taxes as an issue about economic competitiveness and an issue of ensuring that specifically that some private equity companies essentially, like, if they have to face this additional tax, will that'll trickle down to smaller businesses and that private equity helps support Main Street businesses. I think that's basically her argument. So if they face additional taxes, then that could affect smaller businesses. I mean, I think that's basically how she's talked about it, but she really hasn't gotten deeply into specifics about why this was such a red line for her going into these negotiations.
And Andy, just as a follow-up to that, we have an email here from Kelly who says, can someone explain what had to be left out because of two senators' interests, Manchin and Sinema, and the interests of powerful lobbying? So we talked a little bit earlier about what was left out, what did not make it in from Build Back Better, but I think the question goes to, you know, how is it that, you know, two senators can kind of hold up the works and, you know, force so many changes and also the connection to lobbying here?
Yeah, so I think the real reason that Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema had so much power over these negotiations is because Democrats only have 50 seats in the Senate. So they needed every single member of their caucus to vote yes for the legislation. And so while that theoretically gives every single member of the Democratic caucus the ability to say, I won't vote for this legislation unless it includes this priority or does include that provision, the reality is that both Manchin and Sinema were seen as, or there were concerns about the fact that they would accept no results on this bill, that if Democrats didn't pass anything, that would be okay with them. And so particularly in the case of Manchin, there were concerns all year that Democrats wouldn't get anywhere if they didn't come to terms with him because they would lack the needed majority in the Senate to pass the legislation. And so that's why the two of them were able to exercise so much influence. And I mean, to this point, it's interesting because obviously they were the critical centrist Democrats throughout all these talks, but they did have diverging agendas and priorities. So Senator Manchin, he was most concerned about what he saw as an overly ambitious expansion of the social welfare state. He opposed many programs on paid leave, on expanding the child tax credit, on offering subsidies for childcare. A lot of these family-oriented policies that Democrats had hoped to undertake, he thought were too expensive and maybe too much of a government assistance that could have negative consequences for Americans. And Sinema, on the other hand, has always been focused on these tax increases and the various tax plans that Democrats put forward and concerns she had about them. And certainly, you know, it's interesting, I mean, to Marianne's point about Senator Sinema does not speak regularly with reporters in the hallways of the Senate or give many interviews. Joe Manchin is someone who is very accessible to the media and often speaks publicly about his views on things. But Senator Sinema is a little bit harder to read for in that sense. And a lot of information about Senator Sinema's views and that reporters hear and that also other Democrats hear comes from lobbyists. And so she has held fundraisers with, you know, lobbyists from the private equity industry and other major corporate industries where she talks about her tax views but doesn't necessarily explain them publicly.
Marianne, how big a win is this for President Biden coming at a time when his approval ratings have been really low and the midterms are just around the corner?
Substantial win for President Biden and for Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. I think especially given the fact that Democrats really didn't expect that they were, 2 weeks ago, they thought that they would be passing a much narrower health care bill. So I think the fact that after months of working on this, of finally getting it across the finish line and saying that they can now campaign on lowering the cost of prescription drugs and on climate change, which are two big issues for Democratic voters, I think that in many ways this is definitely a big win for Democrats heading into the midterms. Now, you have to also balance that with the fact that we still have relatively high inflation and the cost of living is still quite high. So whether or not that translates to voters remains to be seen, but I think that most Democrats are pretty excited that they have this piece of legislation to campaign on going into the fall.
And Marianne, progressive Democrats certainly would have wanted to see more in this bill. Senator Bernie Sanders certainly wanted to see more. You've been intimately involved in covering all of this. Can you kind of take us back there and talk about what it took for the party to overcome, you know, forget the Republican opposition, but just the infighting within the party to finally get to the point where they got the ball over the line?
Yeah, I mean, Andy was also there all along. It's been a year and a half of covering this, where basically there were many stops and starts where it seemed like this legislation was dead or not going anywhere, going back all the way to December when Manchin went on Fox News and said he wasn't going to support the Build Back Better bill, which was a much larger Democratic bill back in December. The negotiations were then on pause, and then Manchin and Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer quietly started picking it back up in February of this past year over a dinner. They decided that they were going to restart talks. And I think that what we saw over the last couple months was Democrats coming to the reality that they were going to have to fit with what Manchin's vision and the Sinema's vision to a certain extent, but really Manchin's vision was for this package. And there was sort of this acceptance, even among progressives, that something was better than nothing. And what we saw over the last couple months was a realization and coming to grips with that, with just the reality of the fact that Democrats do have a very, very slim majority in the Senate. So there were lots of ups and downs. I mean, 2 weeks ago, it seemed, or 3 weeks ago, it seemed like this package was going to be about lowering prescription drugs and lowering, mainly about lower and extending the ACA subsidies. But I think that it's been a long and winding road, and I think most people probably are happy that it's come to at least some conclusion. But it's definitely been a time of lots of ups and downs, where really the final deal and really the ability of Democrats to get this over the finish line wasn't certain until 3 weeks ago when Manchin and Schumer announced a deal. And even then, there was a drama about whether Senator Sinema would eventually sign on. And so it's been a lot of ups and downs, and the bill has shrank as time has gone on. But in the end, I think that it's a process that most Senate Democrats are probably happy it's over, and they're probably happy that they can go campaign on this.
Yeah, as the saying goes, that it's better than good, it's done, right? Andy, to you, now that Democrats do seem to have the wind at their backs, so to speak, what do you think they might set their sights on next? I mean, obviously, the midterms will determine a lot, but what do you anticipate would be sort of the next priority once this bill is signed into law?
So I think a couple things. I mean, yeah, obviously, yes, the midterms will be crucial. If Republicans win control of either the House or Senate, that will severely curtail the possibility of Democrats taking any sort of legislative steps next year, or the Biden administration moving forward with its agenda, a lot of its agenda in Congress. You know, I guess it's not impossible that maybe Democrats do surprisingly keep control of the House and keep control of the Senate, and so maybe they could come back to some of these other issues. But I think, you know, the main challenge for the Biden administration and Democrats going forward will be actually implementing all of these programs and these new tax increases in a way that is effective and efficient. You know, obviously, with some previous programs, there have been reporting and stories and concerns about bungling the rollout of various things, or making unwise investments in certain things, or having loopholes that are exploited, or you know, various possible problems just with the implementation of various programs. And so now I think the impetus will be for the Biden administration folks in the executive branch to make sure that these various tax increases, climate incentives, healthcare programs are put into place as smoothly as possible and on time and everything, so that there's not negative stories, negative experiences that people have with these new programs.
And Marianne, to that point, what will you be watching for going forward, assuming that this legislation does in fact pass and it gets the president's signature? What will you be watching for, covering, paying attention to in the weeks and months to come?
Well, I think now that this legislation is over, which has been a big question that's informed a lot of our reporting on Capitol Hill for the last year or so, I think a lot of the focus for us is going to be on some of the outstanding issues that the Senate needs to wrap up by the end of the year. So one question is, does the Senate take a vote on same-sex marriage? That's legislation that passed the House by a larger than expected bipartisan margin. And so what I'll be watching is, does that come to the floor in September? Other questions we have include, you know, how does Congress end up approaching the Electoral Count Act? Do they make changes to election legislation? Do they pursue that as we get closer to 2024. I think looking at whether or not we see bipartisan election reforms go forward is another area that I'm watching. But we're really looking to the midterms to see how things turn out for both parties.
Yeah. A journalist's work is never done. Let me take a moment to thank our guests. We've been talking with Marianne Levine, who is congressional reporter for Politico, and Andrew Doran, who covers the economic policy for The Wall Street Journal. Many thanks to both of you for joining us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Our producers are Debbie Bilder and Paige Murray Bessler, and our engineer today was Diana Martinez. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY.